From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, we continue our look at the Me Too movement.
I think now women are realizing that what happened to them or what happened to a coworker, no matter what year it was not right.
Then Colson Whitehead speaks at UWM Wednesday night. We talk with a Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Underground Railroad about the legacy of slavery in the United States and how he came to write the book that scared him the most.
And it's no accident that farmers make good spouses for other farmers.
That is usually how farmers meet, is because of their partners, their spouses, share their interest in their work. That, to me, seems like a good basis for a successful marriage.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Yesterday, we heard from a panel of local leaders at our Across the Divide event. We looked at the Me Too movement and the cultural conversation we're having about gender, sexual politics, and harassment.
Although much of the focus of the Me Too movement has been on high-profile perpetrators and victims, our panelists discussed what sexual harassment can mean to those without a platform.
Milwaukee PBS and the Neighborhood News Service have joined forces to cover what sexual harassment looks like in Milwaukee workplaces. Joanne Williams and Elizabeth Baker are both reporting for the series, and they joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers in studio. Williams said that while this movement is currently in the limelight, its roots are much deeper.
It's always been around. I think now women are realizing that what happened to them or what happened to a coworker, no matter what year it was not right. And after Harvey Weinstein and the big celebrities in Hollywood started speaking up, then women all over the country started saying, hey, me too, even though they may not have told anybody or reported it. And I think we'll find in the subsequent months and years that this has happened to many, many, many women, and a few men.
How has the movement played out so far in Milwaukee? I know we're really just, in some ways, at the beginning of this issue, but how is it playing out right now?
Well, you know, Temple did that survey, the Women's Management and Executive Organization, and they did a survey that found, what was it, more than 60% of the people who answered the survey either had been affected by sexual harassment or knew somebody who had been affected by sexual harassment, and many of them were middle managers and managers. Their experiences often came at the entry level, which we're finding is common because younger women just coming into the workforce don't really know what to expect and have not experienced anything like this before, and they don't really know what to do. So after Tempo did that survey, which people were sort of surprised to find out, oh my goodness, it's happening here in Milwaukee. And these are some women who were bosses who were saying it happened to them. They're looking back at their own organizations and their own jobs and saying, did it happen to somebody I know? Did it happen to me? Will it happen to me?
Do you think there are people who are hearing these stories and asking themselves, has it happened to me? We've kind of been at this level of complacency for a while of brushing off these comments and brushing off these kind of odd moments. Are there people who are taking the moment to say, what has my working career been like?
Let's hope there are. Let's hope there are people who look back at where they've worked and the people with whom they've worked and said, you know, that incident in the break room with so-and-so, I didn't like it and it made me feel uncomfortable. That was sexual harassment. And that incident in the hall where I saw my coworker being semi-accosted by another coworker, that was sexual harassment. So let's hope that they're looking back and saying, there are people I know, and maybe it's me too.
And I think that another part of it is a lot of people are looking back years and years and years. So as they hear more and more stories, I think that these situations, these circumstances affect different people in different ways for a number of reasons, but, you know, for some people it might be an incident that has stuck with them very dramatically, but for other people, for whatever reason, it hasn't, but then they look back and they realize that work environment wasn't right.
Now, the piece that you did for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, you spoke with a woman named Angel, and I think her story really speaks to one of the big questions skeptics have about sexual harassment. They go, well, why wouldn't you just report right away? And in one case, she did report, and in one case, she didn't. Can you go through that story a little bit?
Right. So in the first case, she did decide to report it, and the company sent an HR representative or someone like that from management to kind of assess the situation and see what was going on. And she was hoping maybe they'll transfer me to a different location in the city. She was at a fast food restaurant. And she had been there for, I think she said, 4 years. And she had the meeting, told them the story, and she was fired. So then when she got a new job and a very similar situation happened, another fast food restaurant, she just decided, you know, I can't risk. She was a young single mom at the time, and she just decided I can't risk getting fired again like that. So she decided not to report it and just quit eventually. After a while, she quit and found another job.
How many people have you spoken to who have given you firsthand accounts? How many people have you spoken to so far?
Well, I talked to, of course, I talked to Jennifer Dirks of Tempo. She told us her experience of having inappropriate things said to her and inappropriate things done in front of her. In the package we did for 1036 for the January show, we also talked to Jean Groh, who is a professor at Marquette University, who used to be in the advertising world. She had her own company, and she dealt with a lot of photographers and artists and people who ordered advertising, and she told stories of how she was chased around rooms by men, and she told the story of one man who took her out to lunch, and they were having a meeting about a particular project, and he slid the hotel key over to her. And she said, no, I don't think I want to do that. And this is somebody she had worked with for a long time, gotten a lot of business from. She never got any more business from him. So the fear is, if you report it, who's going to be punished? Is it the person who perpetrated the harassment, or is it the person, the victim, who reports it? And most of the time, as we've learned, it's the victim who suffers. She has to change her position. She has to shift her hours. She has to leave her job or may even get fired. And for women who are the sole support of their family and of their children, they can't afford that.
Well, with that in mind, with victims, the idea of being blamed for what's happened to you, even inside of these stories that you're telling, so often they choose to be anonymous. They don't say exactly what happened. They don't say exactly who did this to them. What are the kinds of things that you find yourselves having to navigate as you're reporting these stories?
Yeah, at first I was a little surprised that even people who are telling these stories that happened to them 5, 10, even more years than that, that long ago, they still don't want to say the company where they were working, or they don't want their name to be revealed. But then one woman said something that I thought was interesting. She said, you know, since then we've worked so hard to get in our career to where we are today. And once I tell this story, you know, what am I then? So I think that even though there is this whole movement of having power and confidence and coming out with your story, there's still definitely that shame and that embarrassment. That's been a common theme that we've been hearing. People are embarrassed to share these stories. So I think that is really telling.
Well, you know, women have been raised to be quiet and not complain. That's part of what women do. We don't complain. We just work. And I think we fear that if we do complain, not only do we risk losing a job or losing a promotion or losing salary, but we'll be embarrassed by it. And the people that cause the abuse will make us look bad. And other people won't believe us. And I think that's going to take a lot of overcoming. That's going to take a lot of cultural change to accept people just for what they do and who they are. And if they do something wrong, they should be held accountable without the victim being victimized again.
We are seeing this cultural shift, but there's also a number of people who are skeptical of the Me Too movement's sustainability. They're questioning how far can this actually go? And you hear specific stories and instances where critics, you know, they latch on to these moments and say, see, this is why it's a witch hunt, a word that is commonly used with this movement. Have you seen that same skepticism with people you've spoken to about these issues?
I would say I've seen the opposite, actually. I think when you hear these stories about Hollywood and every day it seems like a new person's being blamed, these people don't want to blame any person or organization. They just want to come out with their stories to help other people. And so I think that there's kind of being spread around, you know, they don't want people to feel shame in these circumstances. They want them to be able to identify sexual harassment when it's happening to them and to know their power and their rights that they have. That woman that we were talking about before, Angel, she says, you know, if I knew then what I know now, I would have, you know, had a lawsuit against the company or sued the company because that's not right what happened. And so I think that people are being inspired and they're gaining confidence from the movement. And they're seeing the value in sharing their stories.
Yeah, one of the women that Elizabeth met and talked to, and we sat and talked to together, talked about what happened and then talking about it or not talking about it. And she said, it made me feel bad, like we got to go through this just to be able to go to work. And the women we talked to didn't necessarily tell their families until years later. And they want to tell their stories now because so many people, and like Elizabeth said, maybe it will help other people to get the strength to tell their stories. And it has to be a cultural and a whole attitudinal change of the way we relate to each other in business circumstances. We haven't gone into other areas like sports and the military and things like that. Those are whole different stories, but we're talking about people in the workplace. I met somebody in a medical workplace a couple of days ago, and I just randomly said, hey, I'm doing this thing about sexual harassment. Do you ever see that? And she said, all the time. I said, okay. So it's not going to change quickly, but it's going to change, as Jennifer Dirks of Tempo said, when we get men who are advocates for the equality of men and women. And we need more men to become advocates and stand up and say, this isn't right. This shouldn't happen. And we have to have people strong enough to go to their HR departments. And then we have to have HR departments that are strong enough to say, we're going to take care of this and you're not going to be punished because you came forward.
That was a topic that came up. WUWM just had an event about Me Too, and HR came up, and specifically men being involved with the movement, the necessity for men to be involved. And it was a very long conversation with amazing panelists. And one of the things that I left thinking was there are so many conversations left to be had about the Me Too movement. How are you navigating that with the pieces that you're doing? How are you taking a topic that has so many conversations and kind of narrowing it down?
Well, hopefully in February on 1036 on Milwaukee PBS, we're going to have a group of women who will tell us their stories. So we'll see some different faces. The two women we talked to in the January story were white upper management women. These women are not upper management. Most of them are probably going to be minorities. And they're in service industries, and so blue-collar jobs. And then in March, when we do another story, it will deal with an HR consulting company that works with businesses. And they're going to tell us about what they're doing to try and educate businesses on how they should handle all this. And we're going to be talking to an attorney who's going to tell us what to do if you feel you want to file a lawsuit, the steps you should take, how long it takes. So we're going to address those different issues in March, and I think that will give people a broader outlook of what there really is to do. You ask about what's going to happen next, the whole Time's Up movement that the people in Hollywood have created and the money they're putting into the Time's Up Fund to help blue-collar women who want to make some sort of case. I think that's an amazing development, too.
When we've been having these conversations with the women sharing their stories, as they start telling their story and they talk about the circumstances and how things have been different since, one woman in particular, she kind of, you know, we asked a question about were there any sexual harassment policies at the company you were working for, and she's kind of thinking, you know, since then I haven't, you know, places that I work, when you go to orientation, they spend so much time talking about days off and sick leave and things like that, but this is just kind of a topic that's voluntary if you want to read up about it, and they don't make sure you know your rights. So I think that as these conversations are continuing to be had, more and more difficult questions are being asked, but also important.
And I think businesses have to think about their HR policies. Most businesses, we would guess, would have a sexual harassment training. It might be a video that you watch and then you answer a series of questions. It might be a meeting where somebody comes in, a consultant comes in and explains things to you. Sometimes they do a little role-playing to show you what the various circumstances could be, and then you have to answer some questions. Businesses are going to have to stop and think seriously about that and whether or not their employees actually took all of that training seriously. Or if they just said, yes, I have to answer this questionnaire, I'll check the boxes, we'll go on. Did they think about it? What really could happen or what really does happen? And I think businesses are going to have to think about the kind of training they give their employees so that it does become serious. Because if you lose employees because they feel they're in an unsafe or uncomfortable working environment, then you have to train another employee, and that costs you money. And businesses don't like to have to spend that money training people over and over again. So if businesses think of it as part of their bottom line, maybe they'll take a different point of view, that they should be doing some more serious training and making sure people understand the rules so that they treat each other better and that they can be more successful, and therefore the business can be more successful.
Here's to a successful series, Me Too Movement. Thank you so much, Joanne, for speaking with me, and Elizabeth for coming in and talking about your series.
Well, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for inviting us.
Joanne Williams is the host of Black Nouveau on Milwaukee PBS, and Elizabeth Baker is the Public Policy Reporting Fellow at the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. Their series on sexual harassment in Milwaukee is airing on 10:36 on Milwaukee PBS with regular written features on the Neighborhood News website.
Coming up after a break, we'll talk with Colson Whitehead, who won a National Book Award and a Pulitzer Prize for his novel, The Underground Railroad. We'll find out why it was the book that scared him to write when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Colson Whitehead has won just about every literary accolade there is for The Underground Railroad. The Pulitzer Prize, the Carnegie Medal, and the National Book Award are but three. The book is also a New York Times bestseller, and it's being translated into 40 languages.
The novel tells the story of Cora, a slave on a Georgia cotton plantation somewhere in the 1850s, and her desperate attempt to escape to freedom. It pulls no punches about the brutal reality of slavery in the antebellum South, nor does it sugarcoat the less obvious but equally repellent bigotry of the North. Yet despite the subject matter, the book is hopeful, and the character of Cora is utterly compelling.
Colson Whitehead will speak at the UWM Student Union Wednesday evening. He has said The Underground Railroad was the book that scared him to write, so when I reached him by phone, I wanted to know why.
I first had the idea way back in the spring of the year 2000. And I was finishing up a novel and came across a reference to the Underground Railroad and thought, oh, you know, what kind of weird story could I generate if I made this metaphor into a literal train? And it just seemed, you know, I was 30 years old. I was hanging out till like 4 a.m. most nights. And it seemed I wasn't a good enough writer, I think, to pull it off. I just felt I didn't have the kind of chops in terms of technique to pull off a story with its sort of structural gambits. And I think I was mature enough to write a book about slavery at that age and deal with the subject in the way it deserved to be treated. As the years went on, you know, I'd finish a book and think, am I ready? And the answer was always no. And then, you know, at a certain point, it just seemed I'd been putting it off for so long that I had to address why I was putting it off and sort of face the book I was avoiding.
There are such huge themes here. Obviously, slavery and the fact that this brutality, that this crack in the foundation of this country is kind of what founded it. And I found as I was reading it that I felt very complicit in that, in somehow not acknowledging, even though I have, even though I know it's happened, but somehow not owning it. And I found the book made me live it in a way that, as a white person, I don't live it.
Well, I mean, I think everyone sort of relates to the story of slavery in different ways. You know, I think that it's not really taught very deeply in elementary school or high school. At least that was my experience. And from traveling is what I get from people who come out to hear me read. And so we'd rather talk about Abraham Lincoln and not slavery. We'd rather talk about Martin Luther King and not segregation. And so when, you know, I think when a book like this comes along and it is very, I think, vivid in how it describes the violence of how slaves were kept in chains. You know, they didn't use harsh language to keep millions of people in bondage. They raped, tortured, dehumanized millions of people to prevent them from running away and rising up. And it was obviously incredibly brutal. And so if you haven't contemplated or confronted the material facts of slavery in a while, the book is surprising. And I'm not sure about complicity, but if you're descended from slave owners, you know, you have to reckon with the fact that the family farm was paid for by the blood of enslaved people, and that, you know, the portrait of your great 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 grandpa or grandma, who was so beloved, was not necessarily a nice person.
Did you find that it was difficult for yourself, as you were researching this and writing this, to actually look at the brutality of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like a lot of kids, my introduction to slavery was Roots when I was like 8 years old, and then I studied history in college. But, you know, but coming to the material and diving so deeply in as a grown-up, I have kids, and then you understand, you know, with a more adult understanding, the real seriousness of the situation, the terrible devastation, what it'd be like to see your child beaten, sold off, vice versa. And then, you know, I came into the book, I was not writing, I was outlining and coming up with the characters, and I realized just how much I'd have to put Cora through just to be realistic, and the supporting cast, how much brutality, and also just the fact that it's a miracle I'm here. You know, at any point, my ancestors could have died in this or that moment, in the middle of passage, on the plantation, and it's just luck that, you know, they lived to have children, and their children had children.
I think about Cora, she's such a powerful character, and she was somebody that was obviously shaped by everything that she went through, but somehow manages to transcend as well, even when she, you know, she sort of realizes at times that she thinks she's free and she's not. And her journey is such an important one.
Well, I mean, you know, we're talking about people today contemplating what happened 200 years ago, 150 years ago. You know, part of writing the book is trying to figure out what kind of personality would survive slavery, be able to have the capacity for hope that there's a place of refuge in the North, and then have the courage to flee the plantation. And, you know, we're getting our food at Whole Foods and having our nice 21st century lives. How do we contemplate, you know, the kind of personality that can do what Cora takes on in the book? And so part of the undertaking is figuring out a character who can survive and also be hopeful in a way that's very unlikely for someone in her circumstance.
Yes, the book does end on a hopeful note. And I found that it was almost a balm at the end of, you know, everything that the characters have gone through, and all of the setbacks and all of the difficulties, just the horrors that they've survived, that you leave us with just a little bit, you know, that there's this possibility that something good could happen.
And that's the hope that sort of, you know, keeps her going through the book, the improbable idea that there's a place of safety and refuge. And, you know, and strangely, my book before this was about, novel before this was about a zombie apocalypse and one of the survivors trying to find the last human settlement. And so they're both very different. One is a post-apocalyptic horror novel, and then there's this one. But they're both, you know, strangely animated by this hope that there's a place you can go and be whole and safe in the devastation.
Do you find that as you've been going around the country reading and getting reactions from people who've read the book and have come to the readings, do you get a racial divide in the reactions?
Well, it sort of depends. I mean, I think in the South, you know, I wasn't sure how the South would respond. I'd never been invited to read that extensively in the South. And it's probably been embraced in certain places like North Carolina and Georgia. I've gone to like North Carolina 6 times for college visits or libraries or bookstores since the book has come out. Then I haven't been to Alabama. So what does that mean? You know, is there a new South that is ready to reconcile and sort of contemplate its history? And are there sections that are not so up to the task? I mean, I think in terms of reaction, I found it really interesting in Europe. You know, it's been much more successful than my previous books in different countries. And those two things. One is that, say, in France or Poland, where there was a French resistance against the Nazis, they connected their resistance to the Underground Railroad workers, you know, people getting folks to safety, subverting this oppressive regime. And so even though it is about American slavery in a very specific sort of way, it is open to a lot of different countries' interpretation in terms of, say, World War II, but also just that dynamic between the oppressors and the oppressed, whether you see it as royalty versus peasants, slave masters versus slaves, the rich against, you know, serfs, royalty against serfs. And so that power dynamic has translated in a way that I didn't expect when I was writing it.
Well, and of course, we're kind of talking around the construct that you have here of the literal Underground Railroad, that in this world, the Underground Railroad that we learned about in school is actually made manifest. There are stops and tracks and trains, and they literally run underneath, you know, they're in the substructure of the country. And I love that touch of magic realism.
I mean, you know, the book comes out of that proposition of making the Underground Railroad into a literal train. And so from its very conception, it's a fantastic book. And once Cora does escape the plantation and goes on her first train ride, we enter into an alternative America, and each state that she goes through, whether it's South Carolina, North Carolina, has its own different sort of alternative America that it's presenting. And it enables, you know, the book to do what it does, I think, in this sort of compelling way, which is not tell what actually happened, but propose an alternative history, an alternative conversation about how the country came to be.
I was also struck as she was stopping off in different places. She was in South Carolina first, then North Carolina, then Indiana, and then going west, that it felt almost Homerian, you know, that you were having Odysseus trying to return home, in this case, Cora trying to find home, trying to find safety, and being seduced along the way by things that looked good but ended up not being.
Sure. I mean, you know, I guess when I had the book in the back of my head for many years, I would tell my friends what was it about and the structure, and they'd say, oh, that sounds really stupid, Coulson. And then I start saying Gulliver's Travels, and they're like, oh, so it's a different island. Each state's like a different island. But that structure, you know, does go back to the Odyssey, you know, where a hero is tested in a series of allegorical adventures, and you sort of solve one problem, confront one problem, go on to the next chapter, and there's a whole new sort of system. And that's definitely what confronts Cora, you know, the sort of ancient structure of storytelling. She figures out what's great about South Carolina, what's wrong, and then goes to the next adventure.
And sort of escapes. I mean, in each case, she escapes those particular bonds. How has it felt? I mean, you won all kinds of accolades for this. You've gotten the Pulitzer, the National Book Award. How does it affect the writing you're doing now?
Sure. I mean, it's always pretty hard. And so it's not as if, obviously the book is very successful. Does it make the next one easier? No, it's all, pretty difficult work. Do I feel pressure from other people's expectations?
Or your own expectations.
Yeah, I mean, I'm already pretty tough on myself. I'll have to amp it up, for the next one. And so, whether, it was 8 books ago when I was broke and didn't know if I could write, or now, and I have to, come up with an idea, a compelling story after gaining a much bigger readership. It's always there's always some sort of weird problem that is bugging you. And so if it's not this, it's that. So, 8 books in, I never sort of thought I'd have a book that took off like this. And it's very surprising and unlikely and very lovely. And it's hard to be in my usual depressive mood, I'm sad to say.
I have to find your way back to
that.
Yeah, for the next book. Do you ever envision at this point revisiting Cora or picking up her story? Or is this sort of a complete tale in and of itself?
It's pretty much done for me. I can't think of what else I have to say about her or what else there is to add to her journey. I always do a lot of outlining before I start, and I have to know the destination before I start writing. And so where she ends up is where I wanted to put her, for so many years. And maybe I didn't know if it was Missouri or Canada or New York or Massachusetts, but that sort of emotional place that we leave her at is what made the most sense to me and what I was writing to the whole time.
Yeah, it feels, as a reader, I have to say, it feels very complete. I kind of know on some level what happens to her after that, after the last page of the book. I kind of know somehow, things will be okay in some form. Finding, as we've talked about earlier, finding that hope in all of that despair.
Well, she's off the plantation. Where she actually ends up, is unclear. Finally, at the end, but even if she goes to, say, San Francisco, and it's a great city, she finds someone to love, and she wins a lottery, and is like a multimillionaire. She's still a black woman in 1850s America, which is a very racist place. And so, there are gradations of freedom available to all of us, not just Cora. And no matter where she ends up, there's still the reality of the country and the time that she's living in.
Do you feel that we are in a place now that too closely harkens back to what was going on? I mean, we don't have literal slavery anymore, but we have some pretty ugly racist things going on.
No, yeah. I mean, we have a white supremacist president who's embracing all the sort of worst impulses and terrible energies that have caused so much sort of pain over the centuries. And so I think we are in a sort of terrible place, in a very precarious place. We have to hope that we pull out of it. But it is, it's hard to open the news every day and sort of see how the latest permutation of a daily horror that you have to confront when you get up every morning.
Do you think that the United States will ever heal? I mean, again, we were founded on genocide and slavery. And it seems like a very big, big wound to heal.
I'm not sure about healing, but I think if we can learn, I think if we actually teach slavery, if we teach the dispossession of Native Americans properly and deeply and thoroughly in school, and I think we sort of curb our sort of worst impulses, we get further away, and maybe that's healing. But I think if we, instead of, sort of running away and avoiding all these different episodes in our history and taught them to children, I think we move on, if not heal. I mean, I've met people who, in the last year and a half, who still thought the Underground Railroad was a train. Like, when we're kids, we think that, and then hopefully a teacher tells us how it actually worked. But there are people who are like, actually, I thought it was a real train all these years, and people in the 30s and 40s. And so I think that says that we have a long way to go before we're actually teaching our history in a proper way.
Well, we are so looking forward to having you here to talk about the Underground Railroad and to talk about writing and all of that. Colson Whitehead, it has been such a pleasure.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to coming in a couple of days.
Colson Whitehead is the author of the prize-winning and best-selling novel, The Underground Railroad. He'll be in Milwaukee tomorrow evening to speak at the UWM Student Union.
We'll take one last break, and then Audrey Nowakowski chats with farmer Dave Kozlowski, all about maintaining a work-life balance when you and your spouse are farming the same land. You're listening to Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Long hours at the office can put a real stress on any relationship, but especially marriage. What happens, though, when a couple puts in long hours in the same job, or in the case of contributor Dave Kozlowski and his wife Sandy Rodens, literally the same field?
Kozlowski and Rodens own and operate the organic produce farm Pine Hole Gardens in Oak Creek. Neither of them were born into farming, but instead decided to pursue the physically demanding and rewarding profession together in their 40s.
Farmers actually have among the lowest divorce rates as a group compared to other professions, and Kozlowski believes farmers can teach other married couples a thing or two about what helps make a relationship strong.
Kozlowski spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski about not just romance on the farm, but the romance of the profession.
There is some grain of truth to that romantic image of farming. Take a look at the farmer to begin with. We go into this profession because we love it. I don't know too many farmers that are making oodles of money, and there's also not a lot of prestige in the job. So we go into it out of love of the work, out of willingness to put up with long hours and little pay, to be our own boss. We tend to like that. So we're happier in our work. We also tend to, I think, have partners or spouses who share our interest in the work as well. That is usually how farmers meet, is because of their partners, their spouses share their interest in their work. That, to me, seems like a good basis for a successful marriage. Now, farming is also an extremely stressful business, as others are as well. But we have to work with one variable, I think, that most entrepreneurs and other businesses perhaps don't have to, or at least not as directly, and that's the weather, which can directly affect our income and our work and can be very stressful. So if there isn't that love of the position or love of the profession between both people in the partnership, there could be problems along the way. And unless you're of the kind where you have a marriage that is one that grows up as opposed to grows apart, there's going to be problems. But in farming, my experience anyways is that a divorce happens so rarely that it's actually shocking that it happens. That's not to say that it doesn't. Farmers on average have a relatively low divorce rate compared to others, not quite as low as clergy.
Right.
But we're getting down there, and certainly not as high as bartenders, which is the highest rate of divorce. But I think because there's this willingness to work together with the two partners, and my wife likes to point out a division of labor generally, and not always according to gender stereotypes, but there is generally a division of labor because there's a shortage of labor on farms, and so therefore we have to sort of pick where our strengths are and work with those. And I think that creates a team effort in the marriage, and that helps the marriage succeed, despite all the stress, despite the weather, despite low markets, despite the fact that you're not making money. I think farm couples in general have a lot to tell people about in terms of healthy relationships.
Yeah, so with you and your wife, Sandy, how do you strike that balance? You mentioned in previous interviews, Sandy is really in charge of finances and the books, and that's one of her strengths. So what other roles do you guys allocate to each other?
Right now, Sandy's in the process of buying all our seed for the year. So she decides on the varieties that we're going to plant. We generally confer on what things we're going to plant, and then she'll look for the varieties. And that is something we decided from the get-go. Although I had a real strong interest in working with the catalogs and the seed buying, I just thought, let her do it. She likes to do it, and I have other things to do. I've got equipment to repair. So she does the books. She does all the seed buying. She works with all the worker shares. She has that sort of management responsibility there. She does a lot of the greenhouse work, the planting of the transplants, the organ. We all help with that, but she sort of organizes that effort. I, on the other hand, am sort of the chief grunt. So I do the field work, equipment repair, building repair. I do work probably more closely with the employees than with the worker shares.
With both of you representing your business, you know, whether you or the two of you go out together to either interact with customers at your stand in front of your house or your CSA program or even going to restaurants for supply, whether you're together or especially if you're separate representing your farm, what is it that you are trying to maintain, you know, to consistently represent to everyone you interact with about yourself as a couple and then in turn your farm?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I haven't thought about that. What do we represent? And that's really important.
Yeah.
So I should give that some thought. It's really important because the business that we're in, and not just a CSA program, but really anybody who's in the business of producing food and selling it directly, is in a very public business. So you've got to like people, and you got to want to work with people. And when you're doing that, you are indeed representing your business. So we certainly want to be and try to be as honest as possible, because I think that's important. We certainly want to also include everybody. We recognize that sometimes customers could be having a bad day. We don't want to add to that. In many ways, we want to help them. And so you have to be extra personable sometimes. And I think that represents, I hope, the care that we have for the land and for the produce that we grow. You want to be a part of your community, and you want to represent yourself as openly and honestly to your community as possible. And that suggests that you're not hiding anything, and that suggests that you're running a first-rate operation. We don't want to look stealthily. We don't want to look like we're hiding something. So I think being honest, being open, answering questions as honestly as you can, being personable, I think both of us do that as much as we can, whenever we can, because we know we aren't just Dave Kozlowski and Sandra Rudenz. We are Pinehold, want to represent the best because that's what we do for a living. It's our life.
Right. You know, you could argue that both you and Sandy bring out the best and hold each other accountable in your relationship, both as business partners and in the marriage. But one thing that did spike up divorce rates over the subsequent 40 years, there was a Midwest farm crisis in the 1980s. So can you go into a little bit of what happened there and just how those factors added increased stressors to add to those divorce rates? And there's also a suicide rate hike with farmers as well. So, you know, as you mentioned, it's up to the weather. It's up to things outside of your control to maintain your business. So what happened in the 1980s with
that? Yeah, without going into a long history.
Yeah.
History.
a brief synopsis.
Yeah. Basically, farmers went into a lot of debt. They were encouraged to farm fence row to fence row by the Ag Secretary Earl Butz. And so they bought a lot of big equipment. They bought extra land. They went into a lot of debt. And then there was a combined double whammy of high fuel prices and low commodity prices, which caused a lot of these farms to go bankrupt. And try as they might, they couldn't pull themselves out of it. Year after year, they would go deeper in debt, trying to pull themselves out, hoping for the next year to be a good crop year, but it wasn't happening in the 80s. So there were a lot of foreclosures. There were a lot of farm auctions. Particularly farmers back then, so many of them were owning farms that were owned by generations of families. When you are the generation that has to sell the farm and give it up, that's an extraordinarily mortal blow to your psyche. And I think that's why we saw divorce rates go up, even though the couples may have shared in the risk and the love of the operation. Some people just couldn't handle it. And you see divorce rates go up, and you see suicide rates really went up during that time. By the way, suicide rates among farmers continues to be a problem, particularly internationally. Particularly small farmers under enormous pressure to produce or get pushed out. And so I don't know the data, but I've seen it enough in the trade publications anecdotally that suggest to me that it's a big problem, particularly in third world countries.
Yeah, the most recent data I was able to find was from Mental Health Daily that listed suicide rates among farmers to be 1.32 times more likely than the average person, and that's of 2010, 2011. One point you mentioned was that many farmers inherit their land, the business. You and Sandy did not go about this, so you have a unique perspective from that, but do you know of other farmers who are working their family land? And has that strained in modern times as more schooling and career options become available that perhaps their children aren't as interested in keeping the farm?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes, I know several farms where even if the children were interested in continuing to farm, oftentimes of the ones that I know, the farmer discouraged them because the market was so iffy, because the profit margin is so low, because the work is so long and hard and dangerous. There are so many other options for farm kids to go into other occupations that would be safer and possibly more lucrative, that they often discourage their children from going into it.
But I imagine that's also demoralizing for both parents and kids.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard on the entire family, especially when you have a child that does express an interest in it, but you're suggesting that they don't do it. Now, how often do the parents say, no, you can't do it when somebody shows an interest? I don't know that they're necessarily that definitive about it, but I can't say for sure. I don't.
Right.
I'm not a fly on the wall in these homes, so I don't know. But I do know that particularly in more of the commodity fields and in like dairy, for instance, it's a tough business. And right now, dairy prices are pretty low. And it's hard for dairy families to allow their children to go into this business when they don't see much of a future in it for them. Mm-hmm. So in our side of the business, in the produce side of the business, there's more optimism. And you see more children wanting to take over the family's business. There's more optimism, but it's still not a completely rosy field. There isn't a lot of money, but in our business, there seems to be a lot more interest in the work. And maybe it's because of the direct connection with the communities that you're working with. Whereas if you're a commodity farmer, you're working with, you know, Chicago Board of Trade in Chicago. You're not working with your neighbors and other people in the community. So I see more optimism among the produce side of things. I know of a number of farms where the children, it looks like the children are stepping into the place to take over the farms for their parents. I can't say that I know too many on the dairy or commodity side where that's the case.
You mentioned with family interest in the produce farming or even with your organic farming, you establish that credibility through the love of the work, working the land, building those relationships with the community, whereas farming could often seem like an isolated career, especially to people who live in the city. You know, they just imagine, okay, farms are way out where, but, you know, really I can come and visit you in 20 minutes, you know, if I want to. But so it's not as isolated either geographic or socially, and you're establishing that credibility. So on all fronts with your personal farm, your relationship with Sandy, is that what keeps that motivation going, that hard work ethic, all these factors that hold you accountable year-round? You guys are always thinking about what's coming next.
Yeah, undoubtedly. Community support, that interaction with our customers, that is the fuel that keeps us going. I mean, I could have the greatest market sales in a week and restaurant sales in a week, but the thing that really motivates me is when a family comes and a child asks for our carrots and right in front of me eats it. And I've seen children go out to the field and grab a head of broccoli and start to bite into it on the, while it was still in. That kind of reaction to what we do is way more important to us than the money we make. We need to make money. We have bills like everybody else, but that's not what really motivates us. It's being able to work with the community. It's having the opportunity to deliver a product that we are not only proud of, but that somebody really wants.
For our last question here, is there any word of advice or main lesson you've learned through your marriage and business relationship with Sandy that you can pass on to other couples who are married that aren't in farming? You know, it's a good rule of thumb that you've learned.
Yeah. Forgive. And patience. It's amazing how much you learn as a couple the longer you stay married about each other and how important it is to know that. It seems like when you first meet, there's such an infatuation with each other that we can overlook the shortcomings. Once you're married, you can't overlook those shortcomings anymore. So you need to just accept them. You need to understand why you got married in the first place and be patient. That's all I can think of.
Good lesson to keep in mind, especially from a farmer. I'm sure you have lots of patience now.
We do.
Yes. All right, Dave. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you, Audrey.
Contributor Dave Kozlowski and his wife Sandy Rodens own and operate Pinehold Gardens in Oak Creek. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski. And that's all the time we have today on Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Kike.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in. I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It is right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock and Fresh Air is next.